Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
And experts say these newly eligible voters could play a decisive role in the November presidential election, especially in key swing states.
U.S. experts say nearly 3.5 million voting-age adults could be pivotal in determining the coming election results.
Nevada is one of just a handful of U.S. states nationwide with competitive Senate races that will determine if Democrats or Republicans hold the majority.
When U.S. voters head to the polls on November 5th, they will choose who controls the U.S. Congress. They will also decide if former President Donald Trump Vice President Kamala Harris will be in the White House.
And I think that the priority of government from the constitutional point of view should be to cater to the welfare of the people. In this instance, looking at the root cause of the poverty that has made these people to become beggars.
And a Nigerian civil society group calls on the minister of the capital, Abuja, to stop his plan to remove beggars from the streets beginning on Monday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nearly 3.5 million voting-age adults have become U.S. citizens since the 2020 election, according to the National Partnership for New Americans. And some experts say this growing group could prove pivotal in shaping the election results. VOA's immigration reporter Aline Barrows has more.
Silvina Gadges is a new American citizen. Her naturalization ceremony took place on the grounds of Mount Vernon, the home of the first U.S. President George Washington.
I have been living here for so many years, so why not be an American citizen? So now my status is settled.
Gadges is originally from Portugal and has been living in the United States for more than two decades. This November, she's voting for the first time.
I follow politics on radio and TV, and I follow the debates. In fact, I followed the last one on Univision. For me, it is important because I learn what they think about their ideas and what they would do.
And experts say these newly eligible voters could play a decisive role in the November presidential election, especially in key swing states. Over 600,000 naturalized citizens live in Georgia, according to the Rock the Naturalized Vote Project. Close to 400,000 in Michigan, and nearly 465,000 in Arizona. Here's project co-leader Manuel Pastor at the University of Southern California.
In a state like Arizona, people who naturalized in the last about 8 to 9 years, that's considered somewhat recent naturalization, comprise about 2% of the potential electorate. In Arizona, as you will recall, in 2020, was an exceptionally close state.
Nationwide, an estimated 3.5 million voting age adults have become citizens since the 2020 election, according to the National Partnership for New Americans. Pastor says naturalized voters tend to become more politically engaged when immigration issues dominate the discourse.
That's when the newly naturalized begin to step up and become overwhelmingly engaged because they have a bit of a personal interest in it.
Dama Bahati is originally from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
I arrived in the U.S. It was on September 6, 2001. I still remember the time. It was at 3 p.m. in Chicago.
He became a citizen in 2017.
When I finished my interview for citizenship, the staff at the USCIS told me, actually, now you can vote. I said, really? And I signed up right away.
Experts say naturalized citizens tend to approach their civic responsibility with great seriousness, and these new Americans could be decisive in swing states. Aline Barrows, VOA News, Washington.
When U.S. voters head to the polls on November 5th, they will be choosing who controls the U.S. Congress. They will also decide if former President Donald Trump or Vice President Kamala Harris will be in the White House. Whichever political party ends up controlling the House of Representatives or the Senate will be key to a new president enacting his or her legislative agenda. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson looks at key races around the country.
Talk to voters and make sure they're voting all the way down the ballots.
Donna West, a longtime Democratic activist, does not just organize voters for Vice President Kamala Harris from her Las Vegas, Nevada garage. She says she is also fighting to make sure Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen keeps her U.S. Senate seat.
The more we can get out and talk to the voter, the more confident I am that we'll restore Jackie to the Senate and take that majority.
Nevada is one of just a handful of U.S. states nationwide with competitive Senate races that will determine if Democrats or Republicans hold the majority. Democrats currently hold a slim majority with 51 seats. Rosen's challenger, Sam Brown, who was injured while serving in Afghanistan, says it is time for change in Washington.
We've got an economy to go square away. And look, there's things we can do from the housing to our energy policy. We've got to go after this border situation.
In Texas, traditionally a stronghold for Republicans, polls show a close race between Democrat Colin Allred and Republican Senator Ted Cruz. In their debate last week, Allred challenged Cruz on the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol.
This election is his accountability. You cannot just be patriotic when your side wins.
Cruz pushed back on that argument.
You don't hear him talking about the Antifa and Black Lives Matter riots that burn cities across this country.
And in the rural state of Montana, Democratic Senator John Tester faces a challenge from Republican Tim Sheehy. At the Democratic National Convention earlier this year, a delegate said that many voters in the state may vote for former president and Republican candidate Donald Trump, but will keep a Democrat in the Senate. Mary Jo O'Rourke is a Montana voter.
Senator Tester has delivered for us in terms of the farm bill, and we are way too smart to let that go.
But at the Republican National Convention, delegates said Tester's liberal voting record is not right for the state. Susan Renault is a Montana voter.
Tim Sheehy is a real veteran. He is a combat hero. He is a Navy SEAL.
Control of the U.S. House of Representatives could also potentially flip, moving from Republican control to the Democrats. All 435 House seats are up for re-election this year. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
The Little Saigon District in Southern California's Orange County is home to a large concentration of Vietnamese people. Here, candidates for public office are putting up signs and holding events to engage with voters in this bustling ethnic enclave. VOA's Long Nguyen has the story narrated by Elizabeth Sheneff.
A cup of refreshing durian avocado smoothie and colorful baskets of tropical fruits. Flavors of Vietnam are always present in this Southern California neighborhood known as Little Saigon. At this time of year, it is all about politics. Campaign signs with the names of Vietnamese candidates are everywhere. Orange County is home to one of the largest Vietnamese populations outside of Vietnam. Many people came to the United States after the Vietnam War ended in the 1970s. This year, businessman Thomas Quoc Thai Nguyen is among the seven candidates running for mayor of Garden Grove, one of the four cities that make up Little Saigon.
Garden Grove needs a new face and a new vision. For decades, people have done very good work for the city, but it needs to be better.
For attorney Lan Nguyen, who is also running for Garden Grove mayor, listening to voters with differing views is part of his campaign.
Some voters are very nice, but others are very blunt. They just give it straight to me, which is fair because I'm trying to earn their vote.
The mayoral race is among numerous contests across the U.S. that will be decided November 5th, along with the presidential contest between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. These seniors say they all plan to vote.
I have always voted since I became a U.S. citizen. It's my civic duty to vote, to have a say in the building of this nation that I call my second home.
In 2022, nearly 1.4 million Vietnamese Americans, or 68%, were eligible to vote, according to Census Bureau data. People of Asian descent might be a minority in California, but in Orange County, they play a key role in determining the outcome in some congressional races. Mei Lin is an assistant professor in Asian American Studies at California State University, Long Beach.
For example, in the 45th congressional district, Asian Americans are over a third, you know, of the electorate. And in the 47th congressional district, which is, you know, Katie Porter's current district, I believe they're about a fourth of the electorate. So that's a very significant portion.
Vietnamese voters say their vote will reflect their top concerns.
The economy. How can life be better? Grocery shopping used to cost me $70 or $80 a week. Now it's over $100. The cost of living has clearly increased.
It's education. It's about getting more funds for schools and teachers.
For Vietnamese candidates running in local races here, the challenge is introducing themselves to voters and earning their vote. It could be at something like this meet and greet that Lan Nguyen held in a restaurant, or door knocking by Thomas Quoc Thai Nguyen and his team. For Long Nguyen in California, Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News.
In the U.S., recent polls indicate that former President Donald Trump is leading by over a dozen points with male voters in crucial battleground states. They also show that Vice President Kamala Harris holds the lead among women. Mark Lascola is a business strategy expert. He is also the founder of the group called On the Mark and has worked with hundreds of executive leadership teams across the globe. He says the polls for the coming U.S. elections highlight something that extends beyond politics and into the workplace. For more about his take on gender dynamics, the impact of emotional intelligence, and workshops as a way to grow and foster inclusive environment, I reach Mark Lascola.
Gender dynamics is really about the relationship between how men and women relate to each other. And it's typically shaped by sociocultural norms about gender, around power, status, authority. And so part of the battle happening here is, do you view gender dynamics in more traditional terms, or are you more thinking along the lines of more egalitarian, which is shared power, shared status, shared authority? A lot of that is playing itself out in terms of our election.
Let's also look at the impact of emotional intelligence and how it can enhance communication and collaboration.
Emotional intelligence is the capacity in any human being, regardless of gender, to be awake, to be self-aware, to be able to manage and self-regulate, clarity of expression. They understand what's happening inside of them and those thoughts and feelings. They understand how they impact other people. And so emotional intelligence isn't something we're just born with. It's something that you have to work on. And working on that, you know, really requires a clarity about who you are and how you relate and your assumptions and your unconscious beliefs about other people, other genders. And so it's the ability to stop and think about, how do I want to express myself? Or am I just shooting from the hip without thinking before speaking? And it's essential, and it's very core to being effective in a workplace, much less, I think, in society.
So, Mark, what happens when companies prioritize inclusivity in their teams? Does it set them up for long-term success, in your view?
Inclusivity by itself is not going to fix a bad business strategy. So if our strategy is poor, you well know, Peter, that you can have the greatest people working in the greatest way, and it may not fit that business strategy or what's happening in your marketplace. But when you make inclusivity in a way of working together an inherent part of your values as a company and your social attributes and your ways of working, and it becomes an expectation, what it does is it taps into the collective genius of the organization, and it basically sends the message to your people that, yes, our people are one of our most important assets. And it's really about head and heart engagement. It's a, how do you get the best out of your people, and how do your people get the best out of the company? It's a synergistic relationship. And so that inclusivity, without calling it inclusivity, with the expectation of we're going to work together more effectively, every voice is important. We need to make space to hear what everyone has to say. We need to listen and understand each other rather than just talk over each other. All of these things lift people up to be better than who they are as individuals. And I would much rather work in a place that lifts people rather than denigrates them and other more negative ways of approaching other people. And so while inclusivity by itself will not save a company, it is certainly a critical part of the strategy and the ways of working and the values. And it's going to be key to retention and recruiting and retaining the best people.
Mark Lascola is a business strategy expert and the founder of On The Mark and has worked with hundreds of executive leadership teams across the globe. He spoke with me from Nevada, Arizona.
Hi, my name's Larry London, and I invite you to join me every weekday at 1500 Universal for Border Crossings. We play requests and dedications except on Tuesdays when we feature a Spotlight Music Artist of the Week. And coming up this Tuesday, William Lee Golden, who is famous for his contributions to the Oak Ridge Boys. So make sure you're listening Tuesday. It's Border Crossings here on VOA Africa.
In Nigeria, the civil society group called the Socioeconomic Rights and Accountability Project, or SERAP, says plans by the minister in charge of the capital, Abuja, to remove beggars from the streets of the capital is illegal. This after Nyesom Wike, the minister for the Federal Territory Capital, says vagrants there will be removed beginning on Monday. He had expressed concern that criminals use begging as a means of a cover-up to create insecurities. Kolawole Oluwadare, the director of SERAP, says the minister's ultimatum shows that the government's much-hailed measure to alleviate the economic challenges many face has failed. He tells me no Nigerian should be criminalized for their socioeconomic status.
The threat, or call it an ultimatum, by the minister of the FCP, Mr. Wike, it does not follow the provisions of the constitution and the treaties and conventions as Nigeria as ratified. Knowing fully well that within the Nigerian context, the minister of the FCT is more or less equal to a governor. And within that context, there are constitutional rules and duties expected of Mr. Wike, which includes creating an enabling environment for every resident of the Federal Capital Territory. And that also includes eliminating all form of promoting their socioeconomic rights. And I think that the priority of government from the constitutional point of view should be to cater to the welfare of the people. In this instance, looking at the root cause of the poverty that has made these people to become beggars. And really, that cannot be in the interest of these same people who have turned beggars not because they wanted to, but particularly because of the biting economic hardship that Nigerians are facing presently. If you ask me, I think the case of misplaced priorities.
Bakola, some are saying the minister is simply doing his job to clean up the city, to make it like Nigerians want their capital to be.
No, not at all. It's double jeopardy for these classes of citizens. Now, one, the government has made them poor by the bad economic policies. Secondly, the government has refused to address their poverty. Now, government is criminalizing poverty and wants to punish the same set of people. I do not believe that this view is just there. It's shared by the majority of Nigerians who think that these beggars do not deserve to live their life in the SCP. So what is beautifying the environment when the people live in poverty? And don't forget, there are statistics that show that more than 130 million Nigerians are poor, and more than 10 million is estimated to slip into poverty again this year. That brings the total number to almost 140 million Nigerians who are poor. Perhaps those on these streets are the poorest of the poor. Perhaps many will still join them if this economic hardship continues. And there is no, it doesn't stand to reason The government claims it wants to create an environment that is beautiful. For whom? Is it not for the same people, for the citizens of Nigeria? And these number of people who are poor and economically disadvantaged, why do we want to criminalize and punish them for the poverty they did not cause? If at all, these poor people who are begging on the street had clear signs that the government has not lived up to its responsibilities to create an enabling environment for all Nigerians of all classes of greed to thrive. So instead of punishing them, government should address the root cause of making these people poor in the first place.
Minister said this, that sometimes there may be criminals pretending to be beggars. You know, there have been concerns of insecurity across the country and in some instances in the capital, Abuja.
So irrespective of whether these beggars exist or not, if there are criminals among the beggars, then the law enforcement agencies need to do their job to investigate those of them perhaps who are criminals and arrest them. It is tough enough saying because there are criminals living among the hardworking people in Abuja. Everybody in the SEC is a criminal. If there are criminal elements among those who are beggars, then it is still the job of the law enforcement agencies to investigate and arrest those who are using it as a cover, but not to punish everyone and criminalize the act of begging. It is just not fair. It is unconstitutional and it is highly unlawful.
Well, the anticipated SERAP legal action against plans by the minister to begin on Monday to remove these beggars stop his action?
If Mr. Wike does not rescind this is the decision, we will have to take legal steps to compel him to obey the law.
Kolawole Oluwadare is the deputy director of SERAP. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. The spokesperson for the Electoral Commission of Namibia says all political parties have given their approval for the printing of the ballot papers to be used for the coming elections. Divet Mulauli-Siluka says representatives of political parties have been observing the printing of the materials in South Africa. His comments come after the opposition Popular Democratic Movement, or PDM, demanded the termination of the contract awarded to Renform, a Johannesburg company, to print the voting document. Citing irregularities in the awarding the contract, the opposition party is also demanding an independent inquiry into the matter. But Electoral Commission spokesperson Divet Mulauli-Siluka tells me that the electoral body did not violate any laws in awarding the contract.
What we have done as a commission, part of maintaining transparency and upholding the integrity of the electoral process, was to then extend an invitation to all political parties contesting in the elections as well as presidential candidates to observe the production process of the ballot papers. And the commission is paying for the cost of the trip. In addition, the 18-member delegation representing 18 political parties contesting the elections left for South Africa to observe this process.
What has been the reaction of these political parties after observing some of these processes so far?
The reaction that we have observed is that everything is going smoothly. On the other hand, the political parties who are in SA, South Africa, observing this election, we have observed cooperation from them, all the 18 political parties. We have also observed that the ones who withdrew, which is the Popular Democratic Movement, Republican Party, as well as the Christian Democratic Voice, who withdraw their representative from observing these elections, have also come forth to verify and sign off the sample ballot paper, which then paved way for the actual production of the printing of the ballot papers.
Have you addressed their concerns about the printing of the ballot papers? Especially, I know the PDM party was displeased with the process to award the contract in the first place. Has the Electoral Commission addressed their concerns?
I must first reiterate that due to our keen interest to ensure transparency and credibility of this process, We have involved our key stakeholders, who are the political parties, to then involve them in the whole processes. We have provided the reasons why we have cancelled the bidding process for open international bidding and the reason why we went for emergency procurement. And these reasons were already discussed and agreed upon.
Where does the Electoral Commission go from here after going through the process of ballot printing currently being observed by these political parties?
In terms of what will happen then after the ballot papers are delivered, we are busy in the process of recruiting polling officials and then train them. And then thereafter, we have the issuance of duplicate voters' card. And that is not registration. It's only, we are only issuing duplicate voters' card to those who might have lost their voters' card, those who might have damaged their voters' card in any way, so that they are able to have a voters' card to go vote. Apart from that, we also have then to deploy the voting materials for voting in the diaspora, as well as the seagoing personnel and members of and members in uniform, which will be on the 13th of November.
Divert Mulauli-Siluka is the spokesperson for the Electoral Commission of Namibia. He spoke with me from the capital, Windhoek. Zambia's finance minister rates highly the economic relationship between the administrations in Lusaka and Washington. Situmbeko Musukotwane also says the Lobito Corridor Rail Project, which includes a new rail line from Zambia to the port of Lobito in Angola, will serve as a significant boost to Zambia's economy. The Lobito Corridor is a $2.3 billion project that connects Zambia and the Democratic Republic of Congo to the Atlantic Ocean. It's seen as one of the most important transport infrastructure that the United States has helped develop in Africa. Finance Minister Situmbeko Musukotwane is currently in Washington to attend the annual IMF and World Bank meetings. In a wide-ranging interview, the finance minister talks about the importance of the economic relations between Zambia and the U.S., as well as the country's economic outlook for 2025. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
Recently, the government expressed concern about climate change, which has affected some agricultural produce. What is the move here to blunt the difficulties or challenges as a result of climate change, which has impacted agriculture negatively so far?
That has been a very serious problem in 2024. So the issue is what happens next. The package of relief given to farmers for next year is in place and also bigger. This package means assisting farmers on critical inputs such as seed, fertilizers. It includes providing bigger ticket size of loans to go to farmers. It also includes that ticket of loan to farmers, not just the seed and fertilizers, but also to assist them to be able to invest into irrigation facilities. The good thing is that these days we no longer depend on diesel and petrol engines. Solar pumps are now available at the smallest scale to the big scale. So it is about creating that resilience in the minds of the people and the hands of the people so that they can be able to do more. So the response to this is not necessarily about putting a lot of money because we don't have it. It's about policy changes that attracts the private sector to come and invest.
So what do you think is the economic output so far in Zambia and going into the new year or 2025? What are the prospects of a boom for the people of Zambia?
We started 2024 projecting that the economy was going to grow by more than 5%. Because of the drought, which became more and more evident as we progressed during the year, that growth rate has now been cut to 1.2 2% or thereabout. So 2024 is a hard year. But the projections that are there now for 2025 and going beyond, and these are projections by ourselves together with other institutions like the IMF and the World Bank, those projections show stronger growth. We expect more than 6% growth next year. And from next year, with that 6% growth, we expect continued growth as the efforts that have been made to reform sectors such as manufacturing, mining, energy kick in. We expect continuous growth. So this year, tough year, but going forward, we expect just nothing but growth, growth, growth.
What assurances are you giving the people of Zambia? And now that you are here in Washington attending the yearly or annual IMF World Bank meetings, what will be your major takeaways?
The major takeaway is that given some of the concerns about the world economy now, climate change, conflicts in certain spots like the Middle East, Eastern Europe, which will weigh down on growth, the takeaway for us is that we have the prospects of performance above average of the world economy simply because of the resources that we have, which everybody wants, everybody needs to decarbonize the planet. So yes, you can have average or perhaps even a stagnating world economy or moderate world economy. But we have the opportunities ourselves of growing the Zambian economy well above average if we take advantage of these critical minerals that we have, create the correct environment as we have done. I think it's evident to all the Zambians now that mining is bound to get bigger and bigger. And the tourism sector, we are also seeing growth. Policy changes, just by removing visa requirements from the countries which have the biggest tourist markets. So these are the things that we are seeing taking place. So yes, the environment here is about caution, but for us, because of the critical minerals, people see opportunities in our countries.
Situmbeko Mosokotwane is Zambia's finance minister. He spoke with me from here in Washington. In Ivory Coast, the African Legal Facility, or ALSF, provides legal advice and technical assistance to African government in the structuring and negotiation of complex commercial transactions. Originally hosted by the African Development Bank, the ALSF was established in 2008 in the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan. The bank is the lead financial support for the organization. Olivier Pognon is a lawyer and chief executive officer of ALSF. He is responsible for the day-to-day administration of the organization and acts as its legal representation. He tells me more about the work of the African Legal Facility.
Well, the ALSF was established, at least what I can say is that the role has evolved and that the mandate has sort of expanded. The ALSF was established at the time where Vulture Fund were very active on the African continent, and the African Legal Support Facility was established as an instrument to help African governments defend themselves against predatory activities of Vulture Fund on the continent. So the ALSF's mandate was then sort of tweaked to cover advisory support to African governments, but also capacity building to ensure that the choices that governments make and the options that government take in concluding complex legal agreement, binding agreements, that those choices be better informed. And as importantly, that the legal capacity be built within African governments to avoid some of the gaps or the shortfalls
What has been the responses or the effectiveness of this mandate so far, and what has been the reaction of governments that you support across the continent?
Yeah, the responses have been very positive, and the number of requests for assistance that we've been receiving has significantly increased over that period. So the LSF started out as a sort of mini project within the African Development Bank. As much as we are, you know, an independent organization, we have strong ties with the African Development Bank. And the LSF grew as a 50-plus staff organization with over 150 active projects, over 350 projects that have been closed, more than $150 million that has been approved and committed to operations across the continent and support to African governments. So that is to say that the response has been growing and is still growing.
Talking about consolidation and accelerating or moving forward, talk to me about the ALF's operating model.
We provide two kinds of services. The first one is, as I was saying, advisory services. So we act as legal advisors to governments, you know, for specific transaction, be it in the mining sector, in the infrastructure, by way of PPP sector, anything around natural resources, so that's mining, oil and gas, but also sovereign debts and sovereign finance. And we also happen to assist African government with very complex litigations where the needs arises. So that these are the four or five sectors in which we intervene. So we provide transaction advisory services, but also capacity building. And by capacity building, I mean training, the provision of toolkits, handbooks, anything that is useful for government officials to be equipped with what it takes for them to be able to sit across the table with, you know, very sophisticated lawyers coming from the private sector.
Olivier, you touched briefly on the financing of the organization or the ALSF, but what are the funding prospects, briefly, before you go?
Let me first say that in addition to the African Development Bank, we also source funding by way of grants from, you know, international donors, and, you know, some of them have been very committed towards the ALSF. But of course, as you can imagine, in a global context, that is quite difficult. What we're trying to do at the ALSF is to secure the funding that we require to be able to plan our actions, our interventions in countries for the longest period possible.
Olivier Pognon is a lawyer and chief executive officer of the African Legal Service Facility, or ALSF. He spoke with me from the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week in the city of Cannes in Russia, BRICS group had another summit. You may recall that last year the summit was in Pretoria, South Africa. Secretary General Guterres was at the attendance of the summit meeting, and it is interesting to know his assessment of the group and the importance of the meeting. He said that it is significant that the BRICS group, in terms of its population percentage of the world, in terms of its economic and trade potential, and also because it is promoting multilateralism, which is the goal of the United Nations, and that is parallel to the framework of the Charter of the United Nations. The group itself has taken pains to emphasize again and again that since it was established 15 years ago, it has no intention of opposing other groups, nor replacing other international organizations such as the IMF and the World Bank. And therefore, the group itself, I've said, it's a diverse group. He tries to incorporate the will of the people of the Global South, and they have shared history. And this is their major focus, because they want development and they want to find ways and means to promote global government. For the Africans, it is important to note that they are the ones who have been in the forefront since they joined the United Nations to promote all these goals. So it fits as like hand in glove. And the three African members today in the enlarged group, of course, is South Africa, which was the first to be included. And last year, Egypt and Ethiopia were included. The conference itself reached a decision in a declaration, and I would advise listeners to be able to get a text of that and read it very careful, because it explains the aims and ambitions of the group. When you also look at the question of what is the achievement, well, the group is quite young and is still trying to promote South-South cooperation. If you take into account that now you have, as I said, three African states, you have three Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Iran, and then, of course, you have the original members, and you can see that it tries, it's a diverse group, and tries to achieve its best. Let me also emphasize that though it's diverse, it works as unity. Just before the start of the conference, the president of China, Xi Jinping, and the Indian Prime Minister met on the side, and they announced they have resolved their long-standing territorial problem. You also have to take into account that through the ages of China, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, the new members have also established a diplomatic relation after a long period of difficulties. And we also know that you cannot rule out that Ethiopia and Egypt can find a way within the context of it to resolve their long-standing problem about the Grand Renaissance Dam. And all this are taken notice too, because despite some doubts in some quarters, the Western groups are taking notice of Brits. There is a slight shift from West to East. The IMF announced already that it has established a branch of the IMF in Shanghai. Last week, the Swiss Central Bank announced it is trying to set up soon a branch in China. And we also know that many Western corporations have moved to China for their production. These are potential signs that they want to cooperate rather to be in always quarreling. They will learn from each other, and Africans should be very concerned and happy that at least there is something that can help them in the development, particularly, for example, the new economic bank in Shanghai, which hopes to serve all BRICS members. Finally, President Xi Jinping welcomed all Global South members to join BRICS, although they are careful as to their qualification. He said that they can be full members, they can be BRICS Plus, or cooperation members, and these three categories are veiled to them. We have not yet heard about new members during the summit, although it was discussed that two potential members will be Malaysia and the other member in the ASEAN group, and therefore we should wait to know when or not there will be new members at this summit. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent.
The basel of baby, don't miss the when he fun now, can't you see? Baby, Osani see ya na chilonda we. Baby, Osani panga chipuba. Superman, nini na power monga Superman. I'm gonna protect you monga Superman. Nina olimba monga Superman. Caesar, baby, I'm the leader. He was it touch it, deliver. Give you what belongs to Caesar. To Caesar, baby, I'm the leader. Deliver. Chakala, big baller. My lady's coming to a mall. She loved the way I put it down. But even more, she loved my aura. Shit like thunder, beat like drama. This right here is a la casa, ma. Somebody please call emergency. The way the girl is hurting me, yeah. I like her, she a freaker. My wife, she a keeper. No one like her, she a sniper. My type of ghetto diva. I like her, she a freaker. My wife, she a keeper. No one like her, she a sniper, my type of ghetto diva. Superman, shawty say you want a Superman. Baby, you know you a superwoman. So you and I could be the super friends. Baby, I'm a lover, baby, I'm a pleaser. Give it to you hard, never will I tease you. Eat it like sad, call that a season. So when I'm in Rome, you should follow the leader. Give me what belongs to Caesar. To Caesar, baby, I'm the leader. You are shit, I shit, deliver. Give me what belongs to Caesar. To Caesar, baby, I'm the leader. Deliver. Superman, needing a power, monga Superman. I'm gonna protect you, monga Superman. Need a holy man, monga Superman. Yeah.
giving you love what you deserve, my girl. Call me romantic, romantic. Me tired of the lonely nights. Me need somebody where they hold me tight. Look at Cecilia. One man has even money, Sungila. Me looking for somebody to love me. Nicaragua ready, who can pass me? When she call me, vroom, me there shortly. Promise you, baby, me never leave you lonely.
Cause I miss the feeling of falling in love with somebody, with somebody. I wanna love again. Cause lately I've been lonely, I need some company, company.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer Justin Thwaites, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, even if a goat frowns its face, someone will buy it at the market. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
digital baby, sweet at the Wamona. That I Shivana in a winning and a digital. Let's have a little. What's the matter?